So the organizers asked me to talk on the subject of horizons, and I assume that's mainly to give you a basic introduction so we can have common language for discussions, arguments, and so on, and also, I think, to give you some, you know, perspectives and ideas and warnings, and also to, I think, highlight some of the assumptions that go, some of which are not proven, which underlie what a lot of people are doing. Well, I mean, one is interested here, the people here in this program are interested in studying problems like gravitational collapse or particularly merging black holes and things of that sort. And one knows from general theorems that singularities are going to be present. On the other hand, computer codes tend to crash at singularities. So that creates a fundamental tension and issue that has to be dealt with. Now, that could be just an out-and-out disaster. I mean, it could possibly be just completely non-computable by present physics, what happens when black holes merge if certain types of singularities in certain ways were to form. The evolution would not be defined, perhaps out to the time that you want to be observing the gravitational radiation at infinity. But if the cosmic censorship conjecture is true, then in principle we can compute things like gravitational radiation. So roughly speaking, the cosmic censorship conjecture asserts that all singularities of the sorts in these problems that I was alluding to will be hidden in black holes, and the most important thing there is that they therefore cannot influence the region outside of black holes. Now, the cosmic censorship conjecture would be a topic of a long talk in its own right. Let me just say here that there is really quite a bit of highly non-trivial circumstantial evidence in favor of cosmic censorship. There's extremely little in the way of any kind of general proof of cosmic censorship, one exception being the highly special spherically symmetric Einstein-Klein-Gordon system, where Christodoulou's work effectively is a proof of cosmic censorship in this particular quite restrictive case. Now, it would certainly be, I think, a worthy goal of numerical relativists to spend time investigating the validity of cosmic censorship, and indeed there is some work along that lines. But if one is interested in somewhat more practical things of determining gravitational radiation from merger of black holes and so on, the main topic of this workshop, then I certainly think it's entirely reasonable to at least provisionally assume the validity of cosmic censorship. If it's wrong, you're going to notice it in your computer evolution anyway, so you'll achieve this goal, and proceed in that manner. And in that case, because of the hiddenness of singularities within black holes, in principle, it's possible to ignore the singularities, or a bit more precisely, one could develop schemes to excise singularities from the space-time region that you're doing the evolution, excise the interior of black holes. You therefore won't have to avoid dealing with singularities, and you can evolve for, if cosmic censorship is correct, forever into the future to determine gravitational radiation, etc. The one major catch, though, with all this, which sounds nice, is where's the black hole? You don't know where the black hole is, and therefore you don't know what to excise to be sure of getting rid of not having to deal with singularities. So let me first remind you of the definition, the general definition of a black hole. If you're in any asymptotically flat space-time, the black hole region is just defined to be the part of the space-time that is not visible from infinity. The infinity usually appearing in this definition would be, well, the asymptotic flatness usually appearing in this definition would be asymptotic flatness and null infinity, and the infinity here would be future null infinity. But the basic definition and properties of black holes are not at all very sensitive to the precise definitions of asymptotic flatness. I mean, most of the results that I'll be talking about don't depend much on that definition. One could give similar definitions in other places where there are, in other situations where there's a well-defined asymptotic region, like anti-de Sitter space or other situations. the event horizon of a black hole, the first of the horizons in the title I was given by the organizers for the talk, is simply defined as the boundary of a black hole. Now, the boundary of a black hole is automatically the boundary of the past of a region, infinity, and it automatically, therefore, acquires, without any use of field equations or other things, just from general, Lorentzian geometry, theory of Lorentzian geometry, picks up a fair amount of structure. It's first of all a null hypersurface, at least C naught, though not necessarily better, or better than C1 minus or whatever. And it's generated by null geodesics, and because this is a past boundary, these null geodesics have to be future inextendable, so they have to extend indefinitely in the future. They could run into some singularity, or they could be future complete, in this general context. And furthermore, these null geodesics, as you move into the future, can't have caustics. The congruence of null geodesics generating the horizon can't have points where the expansion goes to minus infinity or the convergence blows up, corresponding to situations where infinitesimally nearby geodesics cross, or at least Jacobi fields representing their deviation go to zero. That's simply because if you did have this situation, there'd be a faster way of getting where you're going, and this thing couldn't be a past boundary. I mean, that's all there is to this, to the type of argument that gives rise actually to all of these properties. I'll explain later that if we further assume global hyperbolicity and the Rache-Dury equation, this will imply, some appropriate form of global hyperbolicity. I will define this and tell you what that is. That'll in fact imply that the expansion has to be non-zero everywhere, which is greater than or equal to zero, everywhere, which is the main content of the area theorem. So we know this much about horizons. They're null surfaces with non-negative expansion. But in any space-time, like flat space-time or whatever, there are zillions of null hypersurfaces with non-negative expansion. The black hole is determined only by knowing the entire future history of the space-time and working backwards to see what goes out to infinity. So if you're in the process of constructing the space-time numerically as you go along, you don't know what the horizon is. You know that when you finish where the black hole is and where its horizon is. You know that when you finish the numerical evolution, but not during it. So if you're going to try to use this idea of excising black hole regions to get rid of your computer code crashing when you evolve into singularities, you clearly need some locally calculable information about where the black hole is. Okay, well, fortunately, there is some locally calculable information available. Before I tell you what that is, let me say a few words about global hyperbolicity and the Rache-Dury equation, and then I can... In any, at least, time-orientable space-time, if you have a hypersurface that is achronal, that is, you can't connect any two events on it by a time-like curve, yet every inextendable time-like curve in that space-time intersects this curve. So, it has to be, it can't be more than one point or it wouldn't have been achronal, so it intersects in one point, I guess, would have sufficed in this part here. Then that surface is called a Cauchy surface. And of course, not all space-times may admit Cauchy surfaces, but if you have a space-time that admits a Cauchy surface, you call that space-time globally hyperbolic, or at least that's one way of defining globally hyperbolic. A lot of additional properties then follow, one important property of which is that, in fact, you don't have, if you have a Cauchy surface, you don't have one, merely one. You know for sure that you can foliate the entire space-time by Cauchy surfaces. Perhaps a better definition of globally hyperbolic space-times for the group here, if we restrict ourselves to solutions of Einstein's equation, which is what we're interested in here, is a globally hyperbolic space-time is any space-time that you could legally construct from a numerical evolution code. So the place where you've posed your initial data will be a Cauchy surface automatically then for the space-time, and whatever you can legally evolve to with rules that the general relativity theorists would allow as legal rules of solving Einstein's equation deterministically will automatically generate for you a globally hyperbolic space-time. And conversely, any globally hyperbolic space-time, by starting with initial data on a Cauchy surface, you can, in principle, numerically evolve to construct the whole space-time. Now, basically, what the cosmic censorship conjecture that I alluded to at the beginning of the talk asserts is that if you give some asymptotically flat initial data for doing a numerical evolution scheme, then you can, in principle at least, always choose some slicing so that the evolution can be, again, in principle, continued indefinitely into the future near infinity. Now, for our purposes, we don't really care about the properties of the space-time inside black holes, so we really only need global hyperbolicity to occur, and for cosmic censorship, it's in the form I've stated it in. It's only necessary that you have some global hyperbolicity outside the black hole. So the terminology being used for that is that one would call an asymptotically flat space-time strongly asymptotically predictable. If you look at the region outside of the black hole, take its closure to include the event horizon as well, if you can find an open neighborhood of that that's globally hyperbolic, then that's what, this is just a definition, of course, what we call a strongly asymptotically predictable space-time. Now, the other ingredient that goes into arguments that I'm about to sketch for you involves the Rache-Dury equation, and its properties that go into many of the global theorems in general relativity, certainly the singularity theorems and many others. So it's a, again, simple fact of Lorentzian geometry, I mean, basically just following from the geodesic deviation equation, that if you have a congruence of null geodesics that doesn't have twist, the rate of change of expansion of that geodesics satisfies this equation, where I guess I've defined all the terms in green, so you can read that as I'm proceeding on. The key fact about this equation is that if this Ricci tensor term is non-negative, since the shear squared term is automatically non-negative, you get this differential inequality on the expansion. Now, this condition is a very natural condition because it normally will follow from Einstein's equation together with energy conditions on matter. In particular, if you replace this with the stress energy tensor, that the energy densities are positive. Well, I don't have a pen here to correct that with, but yes, that clearly I've got confused, I think, with the minus sign here. But anyway, this is bigger than or equal to that is certainly correct. However, these global arguments have been checked, and it's so this is not going to change around the singularity theorems or the other things. But thank you very much for pointing out that error. Yes, it clearly is positive. So now I believe this inequality is probably also correspondingly reversed, which you could just get by dividing by theta. This is the lambda derivative of 1 over theta. Right, so I've also made a similar error there. But I hopefully have not made an error in, in this line, or we will have to go check the singularity theorems and others. That if you're starting at a place where if initially at lambda equals zero along your geodesic, the expansion is negative, this inequality, correctly written, implies that there's a lambda one no bigger than 2 over theta naught, where this expansion is negative infinity, i.e. you have a caustic, something that I said you cannot have on an event horizon. Now, one way out, of course, is the geodesic might not be extendable that far, and the basic idea of the singularity theorems are to force you into this being the only alternative in, you know, that's, of course, in other situations than what I'm concerned with here. Okay, so the basic result that gives you information, locally calculable information about black holes, is, well, the result here, I mean, there are other slight modifications or versions of this, but I think this is probably the most useful form. If you have a strongly asymptotically predictable space-time, which I've now defined, and if you have some compact achronal set, which we might as well, because in practice this is all we'd be interested in the numerical relativity, be some compact portion of a Cauchy surface, one of your slices in your numerical evolution scheme, that has the property that the boundary of this region, which of course is some two-dimensional surface, if it's some compact portion of a Cauchy surface, has the property that the expansion of the outgoing null geodesics perpendicular to the boundary is negative everywhere, well, then this entire region, the whole region K, including its boundary, has to lie within the black hole region of the space-time. Just in terminology, I'll call K a trapped region, and I'll call its boundary an outer trapped surface. And the argument is really very simple. If it didn't lie within the black hole, then you could see part of it at least from infinity, and part of its boundary of the future would intersect future null infinity, let's say. I'll use that definition of asymptotic flatness at some point. That point at future null infinity would be connected then to this surface by a null geodesic that would be future complete in the original physical space-time, and which would have to belong as well to the congruence of outgoing null geodesics perpendicular to its boundary. And furthermore, it couldn't have a point on it with theta going to minus infinity. But these facts all contradict the Raichaduri equation if the expansion is negative everywhere on K. It's really only a small modification of this argument that shows the area theorem and the expansion of the horizon, because if the horizon itself had negative expansion at some point, you could deform it outward, keeping its expansion negative, and then get into the same contradiction as you get to in this argument. Now, it's generally believed and expected that outer trap surfaces will form in space-times where black holes form or merge. And in fact, the horizon itself, asymptotically at late times, will have to go to zero expansion. So the horizon itself is a sort of marginally outer trapped surface. In most situations, one would expect outer trap surfaces lying a bit within the horizon to form. And if you can locate this, you could then use excising type schemes to avoid singularities. I'm not claiming this is trivial to invent some numerically stable excising scheme, et cetera. That'll be discussion, I think, quite a bit of discussion about that, I would imagine, at this workshop. But at least in principle, one can do that. So the issue then reduces to finding the outer trap surface, and I want to tell you some good news on that, well-known good news, and some bad news, in my opinion, at least on that issue. I think the good news is better than the bad news, at least. So, first of all, something that I actually didn't consciously realize until preparing the view graphs for this talk, but you might feel, if you're going to exhaustively search for these outer trap surfaces, that you may have to look all over the space-time for them, not just on the slices that you're constructing, where it would be more easy to look for them than ones that wiggle above and below the various slices that you've constructed. But in fact, sigma's a Cauchy surface, and you have some trapped region to the past lying to the past of sigma, if you take the future of this trapped region intersect sigma, that will also be a trapped region, it's easy to show, because it will automatically be compact by regular standard theorems and by the Rache-Dury equation, the expansion of the outgoing null geodesics from the boundary of K prime will also be non-positive everywhere, or be negative everywhere. So that means if you're doing a numerical evolution scheme, if you don't have any trapped regions in your current Cauchy surface, you don't have to, the last one you've just computed, you don't have to bother looking anywhere else. There aren't any more in the space-time that you've constructed. So it suffices to look for the Cauchy surfaces in your particular slicing. Now, on a given Cauchy surface, you can take the union of all the trapped regions on that Cauchy surface. And then the boundary of this region that you get by unioning all the regions is called the apparent horizon. That's the other major horizon that I definitely needed to mention in this talk, given the title I was given by the organizers. That's called the apparent horizon. It's not difficult to show that the outgoing null geodesics from the apparent horizon have to have vanishing expansion. Basically, if they had negative expansion, you'd be able to deform them outward and get a bigger trapped region, so you get a contradiction that way. And if they had positive expansion, then you'd have trouble fitting in a trapped region. I'm sorry, if it had positive expansion, so it was expanding, you'd have trouble fitting in a trapped region just beneath it. So the apparent horizon is automatically an outer marginally trapped surface. So that means if you're looking to if you're searching for outer trapped surfaces in your space-time to do the excision scheme, really what all you have to do is take your last Cauchy surface and look for an apparent horizon that is a two-surface with zero expansion. So that cuts down the amount of searching that you might in principle have had to do considerably. So that's quite a bit of good news in terms of searching for apparent horizon. Okay, what I wanted to point out here is that, I mean, there's also some bad news. Even, for one bad possible piece of bad news might be that there actually aren't trapped surfaces, except maybe at asymptotically late times, too late for you to avoid crashing into the singularity. But even if there are outer trapped surfaces present in the space-time, in principle, plenty early enough for you to catch if you had used the right slicing, there is no reason I know of to expect that in any given slicing in a general space-time, you'll actually catch the trapped surfaces before your slices hit the singularity. One illustration of this concern can be found even in Schwarzschild or in general spherically symmetric collapse. It's possible to, so the Schwarzschild space-time, of course, is loaded with, or this collapse space-time is just loaded with outer trapped surfaces. All of the two spheres at least the vacuum part of the black hole region and some of the non-vacuum part are outer trapped surfaces. So they're there in multitude for you to find. But if you had used a completely crazy slicing of Schwarzschild, which maybe is more easy to see this way, whereby it's a highly non-spherically symmetric slicing where the north pole goes in and eventually touches the singularity, but the south pole stays way back outside any region where there are trapped surfaces. So in this kind of diagram, the slice would look this way. This may look like a time-like slice here, but the light cones are all tilted here, so this is perfectly space-like here. This doesn't look perfectly space-like here, but I didn't draw this terribly well, but I should have had it come out a bit closer there. Then, in fact, it's possible to show that there are no trapped surfaces here, and yet you can march right into the singularity without seeing them. Now, this by itself is not a great cause of concern, because this is a tremendously unnatural, we have to work very hard to find a slicing this artificial to give you this kind of result in Schwarzschild. But in prolate collapse, which may not be unrelated to some situations with merging black holes. In fact, similar phenomena does occur with what, from this perspective, seems like a very natural choice of slicing. With Mark Palas and Paul Todd, we followed up on an idea of Paul Todd's to look at these collapsing dust shells, highly prolate in this case, that Penrose had, and Gibbons had originally been looking at as tests of cosmic censorship. And there you can, you know, see where the trapped surfaces are, at least on the surface of the shell. You can't, you don't know enough about this, or you don't know anything about the space-time outside. And here, there's a very natural choice of slicing which corresponds to using flat hyperplanes in the interior flat region inside the shell in these constructed space-times. And here you can explicitly construct examples where you collapse to a singularity. There are indeed trapped surfaces on the shell, but or outer trapped surfaces on the shell, but you never pick any of them up if you use this natural choice of slicing. So it's been my interpretation of the work of nearly 10 years ago by Shapiro and Tucholsky of prolate collapse that, in fact, where they used maximal slicing, that this is an example of this same sort of phenomena of running into the singularity with the given choice of slicing before you've acquired in the space-time that you've constructed thus far any of the trapped surfaces. So my one piece, I mean, one doesn't know much about where the trapped surfaces are going to lie in these general kinds of space-times that one is going to be constructing in at least the kind of arbitrary merger of black holes with in-spiral and so on. The one piece of advice I would give is you know, not to kind of decide in advance on some what might seem nice slicing condition like maximal slicing and embed it into a code, because it's probably going to be necessary to do a fair amount of playing around with slicing conditions in order to evolve in such a way so that you pick up the outer trapped surfaces, I'm assuming cosmic censorship is correct here, before you run into the singularity, and thereby can then be in a position to apply these excision schemes. So that's all I wanted to say. Yeah.
Getting back to your last point about the prolate collapse stuff, is there any known example where maximal slicing runs into this problem? And if not, is there anything that you would suggest that one could look at to see whether it might
work? Well, okay, so this stuff that I talked about that Paul Todd had, there doesn't seem to be chalk. Oh, yes, here it is. Okay, so I mean, you know, there's not all that much that can be done analytically, which is why we're all here, I think. But you consider this sort of dust, you know, shell that collapses to a singularity, and you can specify the shape of the shell arbitrarily and the mass density on the shell arbitrarily. I mean, you have to make sure you choose some congruence of null geodesics and flat space-time that you know, where these geodesics don't cross except at caustics. I mean, otherwise the whole thing doesn't work. So given such a thing in flat space-time, you then, which, you know, perhaps cross, you know, make some singularity like that, or in the kind of cases here in flat space-time, this wavy line is where the caustics are for this flat space-time family of null geodesics. Okay, so given this, and given this congruence of null geodesics and flat space-time, and given a mass density function, you can now construct a space-time solution to Einstein's equation, which inside is flat, inside this sort of shell. And outside, you don't know how to compute what it is, but you know the mass density. You can easily compute the mass density along the shell because it just is given by the conservation equation. So you know what the, you know, Ricci curvature and so on is on the shell, and you're in a and things like that. You're in a position to compute what the expansion of outgoing null geodesics would be on some cut on the shell in the actual space-time. I mean, which is not, I mean, basically it's the flat space-time expansion corrected by the mass density, you know, a delta function mass density, and you integrate, formally integrate the Rache-Dury equation through that mass density to pick up the correction to the expansion. Okay, so now in this case, I mean, one can give example. So we don't know what the maximal slices are if they're determined at infinity, because, you know, we need to know the space-time out here, which we don't know. But we do have this flat hyperplane slicing. We have flat space-time here. We have the original hyperplanes of the flat space-time. And, you know, this would be as close an analog to maximal. I mean, these are, of course, maximal slices inside. No, they're probably not, but they, right. Right, but I guess what I'm saying is that these slices, I would think, would look tremendously reasonable as opposed to the crazy slices of Schwarzschild. I mean, by comparison, they certainly look very reasonable. And, you know, I would certainly, you know, my own belief would be that the maximal slices are probably going to be pretty close to these hyperplanes inside. I don't see why they should differ tremendously from the hyperplanes. Anyway, you can choose examples whereby you do get trapped surfaces, you know, outer trapped surfaces, you know, occurring on the shell itself, but you wouldn't pick them up with this hyperplane slicing. So, I mean, this isn't maximal slicing, and it, you know, and the example is, you know, again, reasonably contrived, and, I mean, the particular collapse chosen is, you know, designed to do this, but I think it's a clear indication that you don't have any protection, say, just because you're choosing maximal slicing, that you won't run into singularities before you pick up the trapped surfaces.
Yeah. Suppose we don't have any trouble. The typical thing that people do, that they actually have some programs, have some initial data, some slicing condition, they have some programs to find what they call apparently a slicing function.
Yeah.
Really find the trapped surface, and then a marginally trapped surface. And so you get, sort of, on each coarse slice, you get a marginally trapped surface.
Mm-hmm.
But together, what is formed up here, a three-dimensional object now, is of course not an event horizon. I mean, it's not an event horizon. And so I would imagine this is an example of what Hayward calls trapping horizon.
I'm not sure what the definition. I mean, I've heard of trapping horizon. I don't know what the definition is, but so that it'll be in general. You know, if it were smooth, it would in general be a space-like surface. It'll, you know, it may well jump, and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah. In your case, when you're referring to when Emily is supposed to be working with a lot of other people, the apparent horizons disappear according to where the object is tracking the business. Do you think it might be possible then to make some sense out of the conjecture according to the apparent, you know, when the apparent horizons disappear, which might be useful numerical?
So I don't know. I mean, so I've never been a fan of the Hoop conjecture, as you may know. But another thing in this paper that we found was incredibly, in some way, remarkably supportive of the Hoop conjecture. So So there was an example we gave of this. Okay, a simpler example, which had been studied by Barabez, Letelier, and Israel. Which was, I think, inspired by the Shapiro-Tucholsky numerical calculations, but a particular simple version of this, you know, Gibbons-Penrose constructed collapse is to take something that initially is a cylinder, you know, with two hemispherical end caps attached on. So you take that as your surface here and, you know, collapse that down, okay? And then in the flat space time, that forms a singularity, you know, sort of simultaneously. I mean, it doesn't sort of curve up the way, you know, we wanted this other example to do. But this is a, I mean, this is such a, you know, simple case because, you know, that you can analytically write down what the density is doing and so on very trivially in this. And in what we did, we numerically, we meaning Mark Palat, of course, not me or Paul Todd, calculated where the trap surfaces or outer trap surfaces lay, again, only on the shell could we do it. And so one can look and see what happens as you make this cylinder more and more prolate and where the trap surfaces are. So, you know, to begin with, you know, when it's not very prolate, you know, the trap surfaces tend to bend up near the cylindrical portion as they need to get some, you know, convergence of their outgoing null geodesics. So they always have some bend-up character. But they, you know, to begin with, you know, find a whole region or whatever here that can be foliated with trap surfaces. Okay. As you make this thing more prolate, I mean, I think this is worth doing because it gives a little bit of insight into where these trap surfaces are. As you make the thing more prolate, another marginally trapped surface appears here, not drawn accurately or to scale. And you only have trapped surfaces in these regions. You don't, on the shell, of course, we only know this stuff on the shell. On the shell, you don't have any trapped surfaces close to the singularity anymore. As you make the thing more and more prolate, these guys merge toward each other. And at some critical value that is incredibly in line with the hoop conjecture, if you, you know, choose, you know, the optimal, if you make the optimal choices of what you mean by mass and, you know, cylindrical, you know, hoop radius or whatever, but I mean not, you know, perfectly natural. I mean at a value that's, you know, like within 10% of what of the hoop conjecture value, these guys merge, and then they disappear from this shell, you know, at more prolate values. Now, my interpretation of what's going on is, I mean, you've got a region of trapped surfaces that, as you make this thing more prolate, is, you know, migrating kind of away from the singularity. I mean, the thing is, this guy, this last guy here is a marginally outer trapped surface, but if you follow its outgoing null geodesics, you're guaranteed basically to encounter trapped surfaces as you move up the shell and to the future along there. So when this surface disappears, you know, I can say for certain the trapped surfaces don't disappear from the space-time. They move away off the shell and up more toward the future. So I don't believe they ever disappear. But I must say I was stunned at how close the hoop conjecture, I mean, even numerically, gave you the, you know, a value where this happened. Yeah?
I don't think you can have both cosmic censorship and the...
No, no. So I don't believe in the hoop conjecture. I believe in cosmic censorship. Yeah. Right. So yeah, I don't believe, but there seems definitely to be something to the hoop conjecture. I don't know what exactly, but I mean, you know, in well, I mean the, you know, it's well, the hoop conjecture is supposed to be saying that well, in fact, the form that I think is written down, which is not, of course, intended to be precise, is something like black holes or horizon event horizons will form when and only when, you know, a amount of mass m is within a region of linear size r, where, you know, the r and m are related by this kind of relationship, where the r is supposed to sort of physically represent the smallest linear size such that you could take a hoop of that radius and kind of, you know, wiggle it all the way around.
Yeah,
a circular hoop. Now, you got a major problem defining what you mean by the m in a region, and you've got actually equally a major problem in a general circumstance what defining what you mean by the r of the region, because you can always, if you give me a two-surface in space-time and give me an arbitrarily small neighborhood of that, I can find a two-surface lying within that neighborhood that has arbitrarily small hoop radius, you know, by this definition, because you can always find nearby surfaces that are composed of nearly null portions that have arbitrarily small hoop radius. So I don't know how either are defined, but in special situations like this, there's a natural definition of, you know, the rest mass of the cylinder, and there's a natural definition of the length of this cylinder. And so you can really, you know, and if you take what Thorne writes down in the hoop conjecture with those notions of hoop radius and so on, then it agrees marvelously with where the trap surfaces disappear from the collapsing shell. But again, it's clearly not where they disappear from the space-time, and it's my belief that they never disappear from the space-time, but I don't know, because I don't know anything about what's happening in the space-time outside the shell. Yeah?
Just a comment, actually. I mean, some form of the Hooke conjecture was proven by showing it now.
Right.
But some condition for the formation of trap surfaces that didn't have enough matter and small enough volume.
Right. Right. So, So they were using a non-external notion of, so they were restricting to a slice, okay, and so now restricted to a slice, you can't do the null wiggling that I was talking about for defining R. So they were taking the mass to be essentially the proper rest mass, and they were taking the hoop size not to be some externally measured size, but some linear kind of size, you know, measured by geodesics in there. Right. I mean, Neil Omarhout has pointed out that, I mean, the conditions under which they assert existence, that there have to exist trap surfaces, are pretty darn close to the conditions of impossibility of such initial data. I mean, there's not a wide margin between trap surfaces if you imagine jacking up the mass density in this size, then, you know, there's, you know, a set of conditions where there's, you know, you can do it, or there's no obvious reason why you can't do it, and you don't need to have trap surfaces doing that. Okay, then you come into a regime covered by their theorem where presumably you can still do it, but you'd have to have trap surfaces. And at least in the spherically symmetric case, I mean, that's the only case where you can do the analysis, you know, not far beyond that regime, you come to a regime where you just can't possibly have initial data of that sort. So it's not, I don't think, it's not my impression that that's a very powerful, useful theorem for kind of assuring trap surfaces. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, so you had quite a bit of time earlier.
A simpler, just a spherically symmetric case where a lot of this happens, but literally, and I did about 20 years ago when we started looking at this issue. You just take the Bonnie-Ullman dust solution, or finite ball dust, with some, the no boundary side of which is constant. So you have something that's denser in the middle and less dense than outside, and you have the parameter. Then we have a bunch of cases where, in very inertial conditions, the maximal slices come in and fit the singularity, and there are no trap surfaces on the maximal slices. And in fact, the outside is so supply chain, you don't have to have draft turf as long until it's a very conspiratorial dust solution. And if you're not familiar with it, before you look at it, if you're interested in solving it, it's a high level of depth to the surface of my ability to look at it. So that's why a lot of people started. The basic reason is that the maximal slicing of the solution will look in place. The source term or the is the curve scalar loop equation. Well, an elliptic equation fields an integration over space to figure out what the solution is. And so its singularity is pointy enough. So if the dust is different than the heat, then it doesn't get enough curvature warning on the free surface to slow down exponentially, slow down fast enough before the light hits the singularity. And in fact, I think that's essentially related to the fact that there aren't trapped surfaces early enough as you're going forward to tell the maximum equation that it's got to slow down faster.
Is this the same type of initial data that the shell crossing or shell forming?
It's related to it. But it's still, it's not shell crossing in the sense, it's not in the sense that the density, you go out and you have a shell where you have higher density outside of one inside of it, right? So obviously the metal cross. So here it's the density almost monotonically falls off as you go outward. So the shells presumably keep their order.
I'm wondering if the vacuum tape, which is of interest to the two black holes, which might become more regular and might become a bit more tactical. I mean, presumably, the reason why you don't get trapped regions, even in situations where there's an evaporite, is that the evaporite itself is still expanding. And so regions are inside, they're still expanding, but they're not expanding as fast as the evaporite. They're eventually going to in the ratio to Curie equation, the only thing, if you're in vacuum, the only thing you're doing that is something to do with the shear. The only thing that can later on bring these expanding surfaces back to recollapse and form the shear. Now, if you do have a singularity, I don't know, it's really a question. Have people studied singularity? I know that's almost impossible to do, but in the neighborhood of singularity, if you start out with a shear free, trying to start the shear free surface there, can you find circumstances? Can you identify? I suppose what I'm trying to say is that what we're really looking for is an identifying signature that you're inside the horizon. It doesn't really have to be a horizon of margin tested. Any signature that there's a really a horizon outside will allow you to do some cutting if you know how to do that.
Right.
And get rid of that. So you might take point of view, let me not worry about what happens at the edge of my trap. Let me look near the singularity. Are there signatures near the singularity that these surfaces are simply not expanding fast enough? That there's some relation between their area and expansion rate where they're not expanding as fast as a normal light term,
So, I mean, I think the big problem is, I mean, so let's assume cosmic censorship is correct. So you're getting a singularity that's space-like. So it's kind of, spread out spatially. And the difficulty, as I see it, is that, I mean, you don't know, of course, you don't have a lot of symmetry in the problem, or maybe no symmetry at all in the problem. You don't know, you don't even have much physical intuition, perhaps, about the detailed dynamics, particularly in the very strong field region. I would see it as very hard in advance to know how to choose the slicing to avoid what's the fundamental problem, which is the following, that your slices might be marching up in one region of space relative to the singularity so fast that they reach the singularity before, in this other region of space, the slices have even hit the event horizon, or maybe they've hit the event horizon, but they may well have hit it at an early stage where it's not at all distinguishable from any other random null surface. I mean, if you could choose the slicing so that it kind of marched up and tried to hit the singularity simultaneously, then you ought to be fine, because then, you know, you'll see the, assuming trapped surfaces form around them, you'll see them. But you'll never see the trapped surfaces if part of your slice is hanging back in such a way that it's just not it's too early. You know, all of the trapped surfaces that are up here on the slice, I mean, in this picture from the point of view of here's the singularity, and here's the slices we'd like to have to do the problem. If you have this situation where the actual slices you're choosing are sort of marching up rapidly here, and down here you've barely formed the black hole at all, then you just can't find them. And I don't think there's anything really that you can do. Well, you can tell that you're near a singularity. Your curvatures are blowing up and so on. I mean, that's easy enough.
Asymptotic, that's an asymptotic statement. Yes,
yeah.
But that's right. But I want a quantitative thing that would tell me I'm sufficiently near a singularity that I can just cut that reading out.
Oh, no, I don't think that I... Well, yeah, I don't... I really doubt that you could reliably do that. I mean, what I would think would be, you know, not having to actually implement any of the strategies that I talk about, what I would think, you know, the ideal strategy would be is if you do your evolution and you find the curvatures are getting very large here, so large they're giving you trouble with the code, and you strongly suspect you're inside the black hole, but over here the curvatures aren't very large, then, you know, go back a few steps, time steps, and redo your slicing to push this guy up more and hold this guy back more.
That guy where there aren't very large could be way out here. That region where they aren't very large could be way out here. And
well, great, then you get more gravitational radiation. And so,
there's no way you could push it to bring it inside because it'll never be inside.
Well, in between, you're but anyway, the place where you're running into trouble, you want to try to evolve more slowly on, and the places where you're not, you want to evolve relatively more rapidly on. I don't know what to do other than what to suggest other than some trial and error kind of, you know, procedure, because yeah.
Yeah. Very similar things. I was turning it in a little sooner than infinity. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
The other problem is, of course, I mean, the place where you run into trouble is if you guess wrong and you produce one of these null slices that's outside.
Right.
Which is going to gobble up everything that you're interested in instead of wanting. It doesn't matter what you slice out when you're inside the horizon. You can do that in any kind of arbitrary means you want. The only thing you want to avoid is that you make a mistake and suddenly slice out something that was actually supposed to be outside.
If that happens, you should be able to tell if that happened at the end. By the end of it, so all you've done is waste your computer. I mean,
what I'm suggesting is that there may be some operational way of going about this, some practical way, where all right, so we don't have to
trap servers, we still make progress. I mean, part of the problem is that if the thing is going to infinity, almost any of the sort of mesh refinement type codes which you're going to want to be using are going to be spending all of their time refining themselves to giving you that answer of infinity, and just wasting computer time. It may be a fairly good supply nowadays, as Larry was pointing out to us, but it's still not infinite. I mean, you're still going to limit far, far beyond earlier than you would ever want to anyway, so just wasting computer time is probably not.
There are two issues. The first is that to search for a current horizon is a probabilistic elliptic equation, which is much more computer time intensive than evolving a grid point with a hyperbolic set of equations. So finding a current horizon is a from the producer viewpoint rather inefficient. And the second is that I have in circuit symmetry I found these calculations with my polystyrene technique. And what I see is that up to the very end, that means up to the point where the curvature becomes millions or even higher, the relative error, so that means the error of the curvature divided by the value of the curvature, is approximately constant. So if you adopt adaptive mesh technique to not look for the absolute value but for the relative error, you will not refine there.
I want to look at the top summary. Even fundamental. We're talking about trying to find out the numerical evolution where the backhoe is, where the horizon is, things like this. But even we are looking at it, we want to know, more important thing to know is that in our numerical evolution, we want to know when we encounter regions that we cannot deal with numerically.
When you encounter, I'm sorry,
the region.
If we can identify what the reason that we cannot further deal with numerically, then we have to cut that part out. If that part ends up to be endowed by horizon, contact horizon, then we are enough. If not, it turns out that there's not such a horizon protecting it, then we are doomed. But then no matter what, if you do not cut out such a region, we are doomed anyway.
But what do you mean by a region that is not capable of being handled by numerical technique? I don't know of any.
Not numerical technique. You choose a scheme, you choose a computer, you choose a memory card, you set up the grid, and start evolving. And if you can tell what are the limitations my scheme, my grid can handle, and when you encounter situations that you cannot handle, then you have to cut out that part.
But then you have to have a means of realizing where that Pythagorean similarity or where you're from, because if it's a Pythagorean similarity, then you just have to recall in a sense your
right, that of course, there's also a coordinate issue entering here, but that is not the structure of black hole by itself. Then of course, it's very important to use a good coordinate system on the control of coordinate system during the evolution. There's also the issue that there are space-time structures that your coder cannot handle.
I don't understand that. All the computer handling things are global structures. I mean, it's either I can't handle everything or I can handle it. I mean, there's not that some region I'm going to come across and suddenly my computer says I give up on that region. I mean,
but if you have fixed resolution, then in a given space time, if you have a feature that's smaller than that resolution, you can't handle it.
Well, you just won't see it. Because you don't handle it, you just won't see it.
Well, but especially if you're solving a elliptic equation, that sort of mass median can do bad things to the entire evolution. So, if you have some region in which curvature is getting very big, the spatial derivatives are getting very big, and you have a fixed resolution, then that can mess up the entire part of the resolution. And not just in the domain of dependence of that region, because if you're using an elliptic equation, it can smooth the evolution everywhere.
But I mean, this is sort of saying, when Larry did his, we should have stopped because we couldn't do it. We couldn't solve the problem there. I mean, what we do is spend the next 10, 15 years figuring out how to handle those problems.
So we want an answer of some approximation before that. And so I think the practical thing is, can we get answers that sometimes, I think as Wymore said, sometimes they might be wrong, sometimes they might be right, but at least we have to be able to tell at the end of the integration whether they were wrong or whether they were right.
Well, we always found that, and we've known that for years and years and years.
That's right. Well,
we can check to see whether it satisfies the equation of motion or convergence fashion, and if it does, it's got a solution. If it doesn't, we don't.
Yeah, I'm now thinking about what happens if you cut out a region which
cut out a region outside the horizon, you will not, if you absolutely cannot converge to a solution, right? That's what Caron, Friedrich, and Levy proved in their paper. That was the whole point.
So the
you don't have a domain dependence.
You need to have
a domain
dependence.
No, but these boundaries, you want to be light-like boundaries, okay? So if you cut out a region, then you're going to cut out that which develops with light-like boundaries from it as
well.
Yeah, but
if you cut out a part that's outside the horizon,
it's going to eat up everything of this problem.
And you still won't have a stable...
Yeah, that's right. So you'll know what's wrong even if you haven't analyzed it in detail to know what's going on. You'll know by just testing for this.
But if it is just the issue of this practical thing, then this guy, like Ben Krugman and Simon was talking about, what they're doing is they're really looking for this apparent right, right? And I asked before, what do these people do? And somebody has never said, oh, yeah, the apparent right is actually jump, and then you don't know what to do. But again, there are found ways in which the apparent right is not to continue. I mean, of course, in general, they will jump, and if they're not careful, they will jump, etc. But they seem to have found these ways.
But they generically jump at certain times.
Okay, so
for example, the first apparent horizon doesn't start at the center and move out. It just suddenly appears by years.
But after that, there is some space like three-dimensional hypothesis. Isn't that like
then this one goes on and suddenly disappears.
No, but is that what is happening? I agree that's a theoretical problem. Not in the coalescence problem. That's what we want. So why
are the generic case is quite smooth. You start with initial data and it's two well-defined pattern horizons. And during the long inspiral, they're well-defined. And during the merger, it's so smooth, which we haven't gone very far to find out, which is probably the main point. We're talking about an epoch, which is well-packed for what we're able to do. But during the merger, it's still a continuous process. If it ultimately disappears at the very end,
in the merger, then you should get a new one, of course, outside that really does jump discontinuously. Now, hopefully, that should be the initial appearance. With luck, would be the only discontinuity, but I don't know any guarantee of that.
I'm trying to think about the real problem here, and so jumping is not a big problem, then we should focus on the other issues, such as there is this three-dimensional surface, which is not a reference, none of the horizons that Bob talked about, the three-dimensional surface, and so we should really, guys, be trying to understand properties of this three-dimensional surface and expect physics from it, such as how much mass there is, how much angular momentum there is. Are these not the kinds of questions that we should be doing?
Sorry, which three-dimensional surface?
So just assume that we happen to get, some slicing, and on that slicing, you do this apparent horizon finder, and you actually get an evolution of this apparent horizon, and it's a three-dimensional surface.
Which is totally dependent on your choice of slicing.
Absolutely. But it is a surface that is of safe to cut as burning wall, right? Because the event horizon is going to be outside. So it's a safe thing to cut. So, I think this really is what the basic idea of what's cutting horizon. So it's safe to study the properties of this object rather than,
what do you call the event horizon. But the thing that he's bringing up is that you may have
generic kind of example.
I'm agreeing completely.
Where it doesn't exist at all.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I should be talking.
I mean,
before I go on. But I want to be going back to the practical thing that Bernard is saying. Maybe that's what, you know, we should be.
But no, practically, those guys did the calculations. And they found no apparent horizon.
Right. So when that happens, one can change the strategy. When that happens, then one has to come back and look at right.
This happened.
Yeah. So in that particular context, we should change the strategy. But there are a lot of contexts in which people are actually doing calculations, and and there are some claims about how much it is and what it's getting and so on.
But I'm missing, I think, so the viewpoint, I mean, that I was presenting it is just, you know, you don't want to deal with singularities. I didn't say this, but you also don't want to waste a lot of time computing within black holes. So you'd like a method for, you know, recognizing where you can throw regions away. And certainly, theoretically, these outer trapped surfaces and so on give you, and apparent horizons and all that, give you a very nice method for doing it that, you know, that may have some pitfalls depending on, you know, choices of slicing. You may not be able to find him is what I'm arguing and so on. But you seem to be saying like it's a goal in and of itself to find apparent horizons and their properties for some other reason. But I mean, I thought they were doing it as a tool to avoid having to.
Yeah. It's always a tool to avoid that thing.
But then I would think the only thing you want to do is figure out how to find them. What else do you want to do besides that?
which is sort of toward the end of the calculation, when you're still dealing with a test surface, you can't exactly tell the horizon. You can still look at things on the test surface, like this local Gaussian curvature, and try to estimate from that, like the spin of the black hole, and stuff like that. Now, that's very useful things, and that's done on these test surfaces. So they're more than just like the sort of marking where you do it.
So there's a map of attitude that say from this data that we are really interested in, and then see that there are apparent horizons in the initial data set. And if there are, if I put two black holes by hand and I'm in a natural coordinate system, then by experience we know several examples, so there are apparent horizons, so we can start working with them. If they jump, this is not the problem. And then in these type of calculations, the two things merge. In the end, you doesn't tell that the apparent horizons, the event horizons. This is a situation where we can say, well, we are not quite there yet, but we can look at the oblation and say the apparent horizon and estimate the spin locally inside the power story and about as a particularly large crescent before. So it just so happens that in the typical type of numerical simulation, starting with the initial data, the apparent horizon plays a natural role.
Well, I can see that if you were evolving in a regime where you're actually getting a black hole that is reasonably close to its asymptotic final state. I mean, then the apparent horizon should be virtually, practically the event horizon, and if you know that. But in some dynamical phase of the collapse, you know, I don't really see much theoretical or other basis for believing that you could learn anything much by looking at where the apparent horizon is and its properties. Yeah.
I do feel that, of course, we need to learn something. If you're going to learn something from that indoor, then of course I'm going to learn.
Well, but I mean, have you looked at any examples where the space-time wasn't practically asymptotically a black in its black hole final state to begin with? I mean, the typical, you know, Misner initial data where the black holes are close, you know, the Price and Pullen work and so on that Larry was talking about basically shows it's already near its final, very near its final state. So yeah, of course you could learn a lot from studying the apparent horizon that way because it's practically the event horizon. But in some situation where you're really having some interesting dynamics going on near the event horizon, it's not a perturbation of the final Schwarzschild black hole, then is there any example where there's anything to be learned?
Start with the maximal size for the initial data,
then they can try to do maximum flux, and it might stop. Maximum flux in a reasonable space needs to find a general solution at all. So it seems to happen in that way. The movies would say that the rash collapse of flux and all these things work in the most general case too. But this is just the heuristic observation.
But those are, I mean, aren't those an extremely restricted set of examples? Or?
I don't know that either. It's the same as the temporizer. Although I don't know whether the temporizer is good or bad for my physical institution. They just happen to exist in the temporizer.
But I'm asking, is there any example whatsoever where it's good, where the block, where well, initially even the, yeah.
Only deal with problems that they have to deal with, right? Not worry too much ahead of time that they're going to wind up with something that's pathological. And so I think, although we don't have examples of the time that you're asking for, I would put it the other way around. I would say that the really difficult examples that you've been presenting where you have trap surfaces and where you have no trap surfaces and maybe singularity is kind of singularity. They all have matter in them. And that's a crucial thing because the matter is what is focusing later on these surfaces allows them to be expanding very rapidly as time you're looking at them and so become kind of so they've got collapsing dust, so they've got other kinds of matter in them. And the other thing that's making it easier to get these situations is you're free to choose some very unusual kind of flux. I'm much more confident than in the vacuum, where the only thing that can produce this later on in time is the local shear, and probably that's a lot weaker effect than throwing a huge amount of matter. Later on, it seems that the vacuum phase might turn out to be a lot more regular, and that it's not so unreasonable to expect that in the cases that they're going to be looking at, they're going to find trapped surfaces.
Right.
Well.
No.
But then my question was, if you don't,
yeah.
What do you do? And I think Matt gave effectively the right answer that even if you cut regions out by half.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So. That's right. So I mean, let's see. There seem to be two separate things being talked about. And I think the trap surfaces will give you a very elegant way of being confident of when you can safely excise regions. I mean, at least if you believe in cosmic censorship or whatever. So, so that's a nice way of doing it. But if you can do it, you know. If you just do it by hand when the curvatures get too high or reach infinity and so on, you know, that, I mean, in some senses, I mean, it's a little more awkward and perhaps not, or at least if you do it by hand at a certain value of curvature, maybe you'll guess wrong and you'll have to carry it a little further and try again and so on. But you know, that should work. I mean, if you've guessed right as to this event must be inside a black hole, let's forget about it. You can continue your evolution, and you'll find out if you're wrong. I don't have any feeling for how generic a problem might be of not, you know, encountering the trap surfaces or outer trap surfaces in the evolution. It may not be much of a problem at all for the evolutions that people here currently want to consider with current choices of slices. I mean, that's so this may not be a terribly serious problem. I mean, I wanted to bring it up, and I think we've had a good discussion. But there's a totally separate thing, which is what I was questioning Bernd about, which Abe had brought up, which seems to be some strategy of studying the apparent horizon to get some physics out of that.
Right.
And that I certainly can see if you're studying it at late enough times, so the apparent horizon is nearly the event horizon. And I just don't see what one would learn from studying. I mean, you know, I think you'd like to know where the apparent horizon is so that you can forget about it or something, but what I don't see is why you'd want to know about it and study its properties to try to learn something about. I don't see what you could learn about the space-time, you know, about mass or angular momentum or stuff. I mean, again, unless you're studying it at asymptotically late times. Yeah, well, I thought Abe and Berndt were. That's what I was responding to.
Only asymptotic.
Right.
But that's... These are not event horizons, and we still don't have formulas.
No, but they are basically event horizons.
We don't have a log space-time, and we don't have a formula for the...
Yeah, you basically do at that stage. I mean, it's not... I mean, yeah, and you could see that, I'm sure, from the data.